This is Mark Steiner. Welcome back. And on our way to the conversation, remind you that support for WEAA is provided by Think About Your Eyes. More information available at thinkaboutyoureyes.com. As always, we begin our program with a look at this day in history. This day in history, September the 4th, in 1896, Antonin Artaud, the great actor and philosopher and playwright, was born in 1896. And Richard Wright was born on this day in 1908, one of America's great writers. And let's just talk about him for a moment before we move into our conversation. He was a man who was born in Natchez, Mississippi, moved to Chicago, was a janitor, worked in the post office, come from a family of sharecroppers. His grandparents were slaves. And he went on to join the Communist Party after being disgusted with what American capitalism was doing to African Americans in this country. He joined the Communist Party in 1932. Went on to join the Federal Writers Project. When he began and published about a year later his first book, which is, took part of this country by storm, Uncle Tom's Children, an amazing collection of four stories that got him a Guggenheim Fellowship. Then in 1940, he wrote Native Son, one of my favorite books of all time. And then another one in 1945, he wrote Black Boy, about his childhood in the South. And he moved to Mexico for most of the war and then was so fed up with both the Communist Party and with America and with capitalism that he moved to Paris, where he continued to write. He wrote books like The Outside of the Long Dream, Black Power, White Man Listen, one of the last great works he wrote, and died in Paris in 1960. And he is somebody who is should be in the canon of American literature in most public schools, but they don't read him enough. They don't consider him one of the great writers for some reason. That should change, because he's one of our most important writers in America, I think, ever to have lived. And very quickly, this was the day in 1965 that Albert Schweitzer died, a very controversial figure from his West African days as both a physician and some people say in some ways, well, we won't get into his life now because we have too much to talk about. William Klumpser died on this day in 1995, a lawyer, activist who defended many people in the 1960s from the repression of the United States government. This was a day in 1875 that the Clinton Massacre happened in Clinton, Mississippi. This is a time in Mississippi when the Reconstruction was being pushed, and this was a pushback by the racists of the South who came up, murdered over 50 black people in an effort to stop Republicans from keeping control of the government in Mississippi. And this was really the beginning. Many people look at this particular massacre as the beginning of the end of Reconstruction. This is also the day in 1886 that Geronimo surrendered after 30 years of fighting the United States for the freedom of his people. This is a day that in 1957, the Little Rock crisis happened when Governor Orville Faubus of Arkansas called off the National Guard to prevent African-American students from coming to Central High School on that day. This was the day in 1957 my favorite car was produced, the Edsel. I still like to own one. And this is the day in 1998 that Google was founded by Larry Page and Sergey Brin, two students at Stanford University. That's this day in history, September the 4th. We are now joined, just leap into our conversation with our guest in the studio, Dr. Solomon Iyoboso Omoosagi II, professor of political science at Baltimore City Community College, author of Commercial Poultry Production on Maryland's Lower Eastern Shore, The Role of African Americans from the 1930s and 1990s. But he's a well-rounded scholar in all areas. Dr. Philip Bennis is a director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, author of many books, including Ending the U.S. War in Afghanistan, a primer, and Sabath Khan, executive director of Manasa, a think tank and policy shop focused on youth issues in the MENA and South Asia region, and currently pursuing a PhD at Virginia Tech. And all welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. Glad to be here, Mark.
And we'd like you all to join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. You can tweet us at Mark Steiner, log on to our Facebook pages with your thoughts and ideas about Syria and what should be done. Phyllis Bennis, always great to have you with us.
Great to be with you, Mark.
So I was reading a very interesting article in the Independent this morning. That in the cover of the article was a picture of Senator Kerry having a private dinner with Assad and both the women they are married to. In 2009, where he said President Barack Obama's administration considers Syria a key player in Washington's efforts to revive stalled Middle East peace talks. Syria is an essential player in bringing peace and stability to the region. My, how times change in just a few years.
At least rhetoric changes.
To talk about, let's all of you for a moment, let's start with you fellas, the analysis of where we are at this moment.
We're at a very dangerous moment. The possibility that the U.S. will respond to the latest killings, and we should be clear that this is only the latest and by far not the worst, in terms of numbers of people killed in this horrific civil war being waged in Syria, the response is to further militarize the situation with direct U.S. involvement via airstrikes. And we're hearing two different versions. We're hearing the official version from Secretary Kerry, from Chuck Hagel, from the president. This is going to be really small strikes, really limited strikes, just a couple, really tiny. You know, you see their fingers coming closer and closer together as they indicate just how tiny it's going to be. There really isn't going to be any effect at all. This isn't going to affect the situation on the ground. This is not designed to bring the war to a close sooner. This is just to send a little message. And then you hear from Senator McCain and Senator Graham, after they come out of their meeting with President Obama, saying, well, we were very worried that this isn't going to go far enough, and we still think it should go farther, but we're clear that this is a step towards the bigger goals of regime change, of greater U.S. intervention. And, you know, of course, if they keep saying that, they're going to really lose a lot more support in Congress than what the president has been able to win so far on the basis of it's just going to be a little tiny thing. But the problem is severalfold. The problem is, number one, militarization of an already over-militarized, over-armed conflict, where there are really five wars being waged in Syria right now, only one of which is the civil war. There's a regional war for power, there's a sectarian war, there's the U.S.-Russia war, there's the U.S.-Israel-Iran war, all of which are being waged to the last Syrian. So the Syrians are paying this huge price. And what we're being asked to believe is that somehow it's going to help to send direct U.S. missiles into that situation where more civilians will be killed. Crucially, it will be illegal. Without UN Security Council authorization, and we can talk all we want about how, well, the council is paralyzed, then you can go to the General Assembly. But the bottom line is, without the UN approval, it is illegal, with or without congressional support. This is a moment when Congress really has the power to determine whether a U.S. military action is going to enormously continue to destabilize an already incredibly unstable situation, exacerbate five wars. And the bottom line, and I'll end here, is that we have to get past this idea that we have a dichotomy of it's either military force or do nothing. This was the George Bush version after 9/11. We have to either go to war or let him get away with it. We need to act. And the actions should have been started years ago. But we should start now. And that means recognize that chemical weapons is a horrific, separate international crime. It requires enforcement by international forces. The U.S. and Russia together should convene a meeting of the Chemical Weapons Convention signatories to force some level of compliance in Syria. There should be a referral to the International Criminal Court and a commitment to strengthening the court. There should be a deployment of a massive number of international human rights monitors. And the first thing that should happen is the resumption of real diplomacy, first between the U.S. and Russia, and then involving all of their various junior partners, from Iran on the Russian side to Saudi and Qatar and the others on the U.S. side, and move towards a ceasefire and a negotiated settlement here.
Solomon.
Well, I want to echo what Phyllis has said, and I agree for the most part with what she said. But let me go back to the question that you posed, or rather the quote that you opened up with, which is statements that President had made and Secretary Kerry had made with regard to how we view Syria and the role that Syria can play in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. I think Syria can still be an important player, even with all of this uncertainty floating about. I still think that Syria can be a major player. And what I think we need to do is to recognize the configuration of the region, the extremism that is in the region, and how Syria can actually be cultivated to play a role in terms of bringing some moderation to the extremism on all sides. Yes, there is some some extremism in Syria, but I still think that because of previous experiences that we've had with Syria, that it can still be a major player in bringing some resolution to this ongoing protracted conflict.
Well, you think so even now?
Yes, believe it or not. I think that even now, because we have militarized this so much and we've made it seem like it is war or nothing else. I mean, if we can de-escalate for a moment and go back and think about this, do we really have to launch strikes? Do we really have to launch bombs? Do we have to send a military presence into Syria at this point? I don't think we do. There's a better way.
Sabath, please jump in here. And I'm curious how you would make the case for increased involvement.
Sure, Mark. Thanks for having me again. And, I'll have to respectfully disagree with some of the things that both the speakers have said. Of course, I'm not, as I've said, a proponent for war. I think that this should be the last resort, as I've repeatedly said. And this U.S. Involvement would only complicate things in the sense of, greater arms, greater casualties perhaps, and greater loss of life. But what are the options? I think a key argument that both of the speakers haven't made is that diplomacy has failed. It's not that Kofi Annan hasn't showed up. It's not. I mean, we all know that he went to the plan. So did Lakhdar Brahmi after he failed. So it's not that the entire world is just sitting around and wringing their hands. There have been efforts over the last 2 years. And I believe, I still do believe that military intervention is the last resort. And I think the cap of 90 days intervention is, though I'm not a military strategist and I do not have all the information that the Congress has, I do believe that this is a step in the right direction to the extent that it would perhaps force Assad to the negotiating table. To that limited extent, I still believe this would be an effective measure. And one should remember again that this has, this is not news, that this would have some implications on Iran. And if what is coming out of Tehran is any indicator, they would step back a little from Syria. And hopefully that would contain Iran to a limited extent. So I think overall there are benefits to the intervention, in my opinion. Though I'm still divided, I'm still working this out in my head. What length of intervention and what are the, ramifications going further down the line? So these are uncontrollables. I don't think any one of us here has a crystal ball to look at and say, what's going to happen in the future. But given the facts, given the situation today, and given what has happened over the last 2 years, I do believe that some kind of involvement, even if it is, there have been interventions in the past which have been successful and which haven't entirely been legal. So I think flouting, quoting international norms, and saying that is the only thing which should stop us is, in my opinion, I think once in a while you have to break laws.
You have to break laws?
I mean,
well, the U.S. certainly does.
I'm sorry, I avoided that a little carelessly.
Okay, Phyllis, Phyllis, jump in. What were you about to say, Phyllis?
Sure.
I was just going to say the U.S. violates international law all the time. I don't think that's a question. Of course we can. The point
right.
is, does it work and what's the effect of it? And I think, first of all, I would really disagree that diplomacy has failed. Diplomacy has not been serious.
I agree.
Kofi was sent to the region without any serious backing from the powers on the Security Council. The same with Lakhdar Brahimi. Last week the U.S. canceled a meeting it had scheduled with the Russians to talk about renegotiating a Geneva II type mm-hmm. negotiation. Mm-hmm. 3 months ago, Russia did the same thing, canceled the meeting that had been scheduled. In both cases, it was because their respective sides were not doing very well on the battlefield, and they didn't want to talk until they could do better militarily. That could go on forever at the cost of enormous numbers of Syrian lives. So I think that we have to be serious about tough diplomacy.
I agree.
And the U.S. is going to have to give up a lot as we push Russia to stop arming the Syrian regime and stop allowing Iran to arm the Syrian regime. We're going to have to stop Saudi Arabia and Qatar and Turkey and Jordan from arming and training the Syrian rebels, and threaten them that if they don't, that we will cut off all existing contracts for our own military corporations with those countries. There's a precedent for this.
I want to agree with Phyllis. That's the point I was getting to, actually, because I think that we have not used our diplomatic tools and weapons that is in the arsenal, and we haven't tapped into them. There is this drum beat for military action as if that would be the solution. Let's not forget that there is a revenge culture in the Arab, There is a revenge element in the Arab culture. And so if we take any military action now, we may have a momentary feel-good outcome, but there's a long-term consequence that will linger long after the dust has settled. And so I think we need to explore the diplomatic and economic and even political options that are on the table that we have not even talked about. And Saudi Arabia has an interest, has a dog in this fight. The Qatar, the other Gulf countries that clearly can benefit from having the kind of diplomatic arrangement or diplomatic solution that can come from this conflict. So we need to really go back and use all of the tools that we have at our disposal to pursue the diplomatic option. And I don't want to believe that that option is not going to work because we haven't tried it. We as a nation have always gotten through when we employ our diplomatic resources when we want to get a result, except there is a particular or there's a must-have interest of sort that we must send a message. We must teach President Assad a lesson that you're not supposed to do this. I think our foreign policy should be more than just teaching somebody a lesson. It should be more than saying, okay, we've sent a message, now he's not going to do it again. I don't think that's the outcome we want. We want to have a stable region that is friendly to us, to our vital regional and international interests, even security interests.
So, I mean, I'm not so sure, and Sabat, very quickly, I'm going to come back to Phyllis, but I'm not so sure that I think it's very difficult to justify lobbying of any kind of missiles or drones towards Syria that's going to change anything, do anything that would have an effect. So it's hard. I'm really hard put to find the logic in it. If you could give it to us, I'd like to hear it.
Sure, Mark. I want to start off by saying all of this is hypothetical. You know, I think we're all discussing situations which are likely to pan out in very different ways. So I'll say that with a lot of humility. And again, I want to be clear that I'm not making a case for enormous intervention or, you know, blowing up the whole place or taking revenge, as someone pointed out earlier. I think the impact in my understanding of the situation today is if this intervention, if a few missiles dropped at key locations, do push Iran back, do force Assad to the negotiating table. I think that is a key point which has not been stressed enough. We speak of diplomacy, but is Assad interested in diplomacy? Are the other regional partners interested in speaking to them? I'm not again saying the U.S. has tried its best. Of course not. Nor has Russia. I mean, of course, the Snowden affair and other, you know, relations have, of course, you know, impacted what is going on between U.S. and Russia, and that is extremely unfortunate. But given these situations, what are the options? How do you get somebody to talk to you and take you seriously? I think that is the heart of the question here. Ban Ki-moon, I was just reading the BBC in the morning today, he said, we must put an end to atrocities. Noam Chomsky, who I hugely admire and I think is has spoken very thoughtfully about this issue, said a few weeks ago that the world must help the rebels. And how do you help the rebels? How do you put an end to the atrocities? How do you get out of this situation? And at least, in my understanding, if any action taken forces Assad to negotiate, pushes back Iran, that is job accomplished, in my understanding. And how things will pan out 6 months from now, I do not know. Nor do I claim to, you know,
Phyllis, go ahead.
We're looking at a very tight timeline. You know, we can sit here and pontificate about what might happen, sure, and we can't be too sure. The Congress is going to vote in the next 7 days. They're probably going to vote yes, but we have a chance to make them vote no. If they vote no, it's possible. It's not likely, but it's just possible that maybe the Obama administration will not go ahead with as isolated as they are in the world, without the Brits, without NATO, without the Arab League signing on, in full direct violation of international law. The question is, number one, they admit that this is not designed to bring the war to an end any sooner.
Right.
It's not going to help the people of Syria that are suffering through this war. So we have to get off the notion that somehow maybe this will help. It's not going to help. This is designed to send a political message,
a message,
which may or may not be taken, but it's not going to help people on the ground. What the question is, What happens the day after?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
we can talk about how small this will be, and I think that's probably their intention. Just a couple of hundred cruise missiles, which will kill only a few civilians. But then what happens the day after? Syria and its colleagues decide that they're going to retaliate. They could attack one of the U.S. warships off the Syrian
mm-hmm.
coast.
Mm-hmm.
They could send a missile attack on U.S. troops all over the region. They could attack either directly or by proxy U.S. bases in neighboring countries. They could attack CENTCOM command headquarters in Qatar. They could attack a drone base in Saudi Arabia. They could attack Israel. They could get the Iranians to sink a ship in the Strait of Hormuz. And they could do all that before breakfast.
And Phyllis, you're
right.
And then
what happens with the U.S.? That's when we start talking about major escalation.
Phyllis, you're right. And that's my concern. The long term, the morning after, when
exactly.
we've dropped whatever we're going to drop, and when we've sent whatever message we're going to send. And I said earlier, there is a revenge element in the Arab culture.
And
they're
in
not,
our own.
They are not
and
going,
in our own.
Yes. They're not going to sit by and just take whatever we
not
dish the, out to them.
Not at this point.
Not going to happen.
I wonder if, you know, if nobody is even talking about, let's say, the 1 million children, Syrian children, who are now refugees.
Right.
Refugee camps that are becoming one of the largest populations in Jordan, Turkey, Lebanon. Would it not be wiser for America to think about addressing the refugee problem as
absolutely.
A way, as
including
a way
to, money and including taking some of those refugees and resettling them, those that want to, here? Something we refuse to do in Iraq, where we were at war and still refuse to allow refugees to come to this country. The U.S. pays the largest amount of any single country, but it is paltry relative to the obligation that we have to people in that region. We should be spending all of this money that is being used now to keep six warships in the Mediterranean off the coast of Syria to rebuild cities, help the refugees, resettle people, rebuild. You know, this is the use, how the money gets used, aside from the domestic needs. This becomes a very dangerous reality. It also is going to lead to calls in Congress, we're already hearing some of them, that this military escalation is proof of why the sequester should not be applied to the Pentagon budget. The Pentagon budget should be given free rein, and there should be even deeper cuts in schools, jobs, education, hospitals, et cetera.
Well, Sunni Khalid has written in a text, he wrote, if history teaches us anything about Syria or its backers, the Assads will not accept any deal but their deal, one that leaves them in power, and they are willing to fight to the last Syrian. Isn't this an existential proposition for the Assads and their Islamists and other rebels facing them? And so let me say, Sunni Khalid was a foreign correspondent for a long time
mm-hmm.
in Lebanon, in Syria, and Jordan, and in a lot of other war zones. So,
and this is why I'm wondering, why can't we talk to President Assad? Why can't we talk to him? I mean, really, why can't we talk? We want to talk to the rebels. We want to talk to the Free Syrian Army. But why can't we talk to President Assad?
So we have to take a break here, but I'm going to say that this Friday at 9 o'clock, we're going to come back to Syria here on the Mark Steiner Show. We'll be out tomorrow, but we'll be back on Friday at 9 a.m. With some congressional representatives and others that we're going to be talking to, because this really is a time for the American people to let their representatives hear
it is.
What they think.
It is.
Whether they vote yes or no in Congress, we'll see. There are a lot of congressional representatives in our listening area, this Mid-Atlantic, who are tottering back and forth, not sure which way they are going to vote.
Well, this is serious stuff.
It's very serious, and so we need to. You can affect that as citizens of this country. So we have to start our special that we've been waiting for weeks to begin, our Baltimore, Detroit, Oakland series that starts now. But when we come back Friday morning, maybe with some of these same guests and others, we're going to really pursue this in some depth and tell you how to contact your representatives, let them know how you feel. We'll have that on our website, because voices have to be heard before another war is declared and gets us deeper into the muck and the mire. And I want to thank, as always, Phyllis Benes. Phyllis, it's always great to have you on the air. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mark.
And Dr. Solomon Iyabosu Omoasagie II, always good to see you.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
And Sabath Khan, thank you for being one of our news commentators. Good to have you with us as well.
Thank you, Mark. Have a great day. Thank you.
We're going to take a break. Come back with Dr. Lester Spence, Baltimore, Detroit, Oakland. Don't go away.